Hi, Damien Carrick here. Welcome to Law Report Summer. Today, part three of a special documentary series on the trial of Leon Borthwick, who was charged with murder after he ran down 19-year-old Mark Zimmer. Made over almost 2 years, this series follows the trial from the perspective of Mark Zimmer's family and also from the perspective of the prosecution team. As we heard last week, the verdict was handed down in early July 2010. The jury found Borthwick guilty of manslaughter. Normally, sentencing takes place a few weeks later, but for various reasons, the sentencing hearing was not scheduled until September 2010. As we've heard over the last 2 weeks, the Zimmers are frustrated by the justice system. One of their main criticisms is that victim families do not have any real participation in the trial. But throughout the entire legal process, the family look forward to the sentencing hearing, where they will have an opportunity to tell the court how the crime has affected their family. Unfortunately, when the sentencing hearing finally takes place in September, those hopes are dashed.
Mark Zimmer's grieving family wanted the chance to express their feelings by reading out their victim impact statements in court. But today, that right was taken away.
My heart on those pieces of paper, and they just destroyed me again.
Today, Justice Catherine Williams was meant to hear pleas and sentence Borthwick. Instead, she spent an hour and a half editing the Zimmer family's statements aloud in the courtroom. During the hearing, Cornelia Zimmer became so frustrated, she tore her statement in half, then shouted, "I can't even read how it affects me," and stormed out.
Like Cornelia, Mark's father, Christian, is devastated by the changes made to his victim impact statement.
Up until now, I've just had to sit there, quiet truce, over 6 weeks of trial, and I haven't been able to say a thing. So this was the first time for me to explain to the court how this crime has affected my life and my family's life.
Cornelia, how important was this moment for you?
It was putting my heart and my soul into making sure that the courts, people that were listening, the public, and I guess some small hope that Leon would actually feel some sense of what he'd done to us.
In court this morning, you were all prepared to give your victim impact statements, but that didn't happen. What happened in court?
Well, we prepared our victim impact statement well in advance. We submitted it to the prosecution and the defence. So we came to court today expecting to have our day in court and to be able to read our impact statements in front of the court, only to hear that the defence had objections to our statements and that the defence wanted ours to edit our statements. And then we also found out that it was their right to edit our statements. We couldn't tell the court how we felt. It was up to the defence to be able to edit how we felt.
What exactly did they successfully take out of your victim impact statement?
I wrote in my statement that Leon Borthwick brutally ran down and killed my son, and that was too harsh, and I'm not allowed to say that he brutally ran down and killed my son.
Cornelia, what was taken out of your statement?
The question is, what wasn't? It's my memories of my brother, the relationship that we had that we no longer can have. It was about the brutal few months that he had to live through and how it actually traumatises me that he had to go through being harassed, threatened, held a knife to, and that really distresses me, obviously, that he had to bear that for so long before he was actually killed. I dream about that, and that does impact me. That is the impact of the crime. I'm pretty sure, as I left early, I've just been told that the whole end of my statement has been removed. One of the main things that I said in there was that there's no other word that I can think of that describes Leon but evil. And I said that no matter where compassion lies in sentencing, the only thing that is fact is that Mark is dead and he died at the hands of Leon Borthwick. And apparently that was too controversial, even though it is a fact. I also went on to say a lot about my experiences since then, my psychological experiences and the way it's impacted my future life, pretty much it went from a 5-page document to, I'll be lucky if it's a page and a half at this rate.
We did spend a lot of effort and a lot of tears went into this, and really we put our heart and soul into this. And to have it torn apart in front of us at the court, where they had plenty of time to review it prior to today's hearing, and they just didn't care. They were heartless and they tore it in front of us, in front of the court, and then they expect us to be quiet about it.
The defence are concerned that the Zimmer victim impact statements contain material that goes beyond the effect of the crime on the family. And this is of concern because the family want their statements read out in open court rather than be handed up to the judge in written form. The defence don't want what they say is irrelevant material to become part of the court's public record. Michelle Williams SC is the Crown prosecutor in the case. She doesn't buy this argument. She's surprised and she's angry that the Zimmer family's statements are red-penned in court.
We very much tell them, after a verdict, now's your chance, you can say in your words how this has affected you. And that's what they had done as far as I was concerned. I had looked at them, I didn't see anything objectionable, but, you know, it's in the eyes of the beholder, I suppose. Parts were objected to and the judge ruled on those parts. Now, sometimes that does happen and we're put on notice about that and we can, if you like, have some debate about it, but not in the way it was done this time.
So the defence team had the chance to look at and think about these statements well before the actual court sitting.
That's right, and normally what would happen, and sometimes does happen, is that usually defence will ring me, the barrister, or maybe my instructor and say, look, not too sure about this bit, do you mind? You know, really some sensitivity in the way that it's done, that didn't occur here.
Of course, this has attracted a lot of media attention, and leading Victorian Supreme Court Judge Justice Paul Coghlan has said there's a need for new guidelines around victim impact statements. What has he suggested?
Yes, that's a positive that we would see that's come out of this particular situation. My understanding is that Justice Paul Coghlan, who is also the listing judge, has said that there is a need for guidelines or a practice note. He has been in discussion, as I understand it, with the criminal bar and or the profession as a whole, that is the practitioners. And he is also making orders for matters when they're listed in front of him for victim impact statements to be served in a timely fashion. I'm not sure whether he's actually giving dates, but to ensure that that's done. Also to ask the Crown whether the victims wish to read their victim impact statement out so that defence are put on notice so that we don't have what happened in this case reoccurring. And thirdly, that if defence want to object to anything or any part of a victim impact statement, that they put us, the Crown, on notice so that, again, we don't have what occurred in this case.
Michelle Williams, SC, would you distinguish the victim impact statements of the Zimmers from the victim impact statements of other victims and other victim families?
No, from my point of view, I didn't see anything out there, so to speak, in their victim impact statements. I mean, most defence don't take the point. They might acknowledge that there are words in a victim impact statement, their own words, that technically might be objectionable. But it's often said to the judge that, from defence's point of view, that there are inadmissible parts. But we're not taking the point, Your Honour. But we ask Your Honour to ignore those parts or give little weight to those parts. That's been the usual practice. That wasn't what happened here.
The Zimmers have mixed emotions. They're pleased that the controversy leads to a change in the way victim impact statements will be handled in future Victorian trials, but angry that their statements are amended. And what's more, that the court time devoted to this task means that the actual sentencing hearing now needs to be postponed for another 3 months. The sentencing hearing is now scheduled for the 16th of December 2010. But Cornelia no longer plans to read out in court her victim impact statement. She no longer has any confidence in the sentencing process.
I felt that it was pretty much unrecognisable to what I'd originally written. And basically I thought, well, they're not my words and therefore I refuse to read them.
At the hearing, Michelle Williams reads out the victim impact statements of both Cornelia and Christian. Ruth Zimmer, Mark's mother, chooses to read out her statement. She tells the court that Mark was loving, gentle and funny. She describes how she misses his kisses and hugs and how she cries every day because she aches for her dead son and because of the pain she sees in the eyes of her husband and daughter. After hearing the victim impact statements, the court then hears submissions from the prosecution and defence. The defence points to the offender's youth and submit that he has shown genuine remorse. The prosecution focus on the seriousness of the crime and they dispute that he has shown any remorse. A good deal of the hearing focuses on an issue that doesn't come up in many trials. During the trial back in mid-2010, the judge directed the jury to consider two forms of manslaughter: manslaughter by dangerous unlawful act and the less common and less serious manslaughter by criminal negligence. The jury returned a verdict of manslaughter, but they weren't asked which form. And now, for sentencing purposes, the presiding judge has to decide which form of manslaughter Leon Borthwick committed.
Yes, it's slightly unusual, doesn't often happen. The jury brought back not guilty of murder, but a guilty to the alternative of manslaughter. But they do not bring back a verdict of which form of manslaughter.
The factual basis of both of those are quite different. Just briefly describe to me what those two definitions are.
Yeah, well, they are extremely different. Manslaughter via criminal negligence really is more concentrating on the form of the driving. That is, that the driving, to put it in layman's language, is so bad that it deserves to be called criminally negligent. So it's a high standard. It's not dangerous driving, it's not careless driving. It's a very, again, layman's language, not the legal terminology, but very bad form of driving. But it doesn't necessarily take into account, in fact, doesn't take into account any intent to harm. Manslaughter, unlawful and dangerous act is, again, if you're looking at the driving, we went to the jury and said, look, the driving is he was aiming at him, and if you're not satisfied at that time that he intended to kill him or cause really serious injury, but you have a doubt about that, but you nevertheless say he aimed the car at him, he was deliberately driving at him, but he intended to harm him in some way or clip him or frighten him or something like that. That's unlawful dangerous act manslaughter in the circumstances of this case.
Okay, so you put those as alternatives to the jury. They came back and they were clearly satisfied with one or both of them, and they came back with the guilty to manslaughter, but they didn't specify which manslaughter they found. Is it possible that six found one and six found the other?
Yes, absolutely, and that's the dilemma now, I suppose. We don't know. Some could have found, in fact, I suppose 11 could have found for unlawful dangerous act and one for criminal negligence or a combination therein. So we don't know which form. It now makes it quite a difficult task for the sentencing judge. And we've just had 2 days, in effect, of a plea hearing whereby we've gone over some of the evidence. Our argument is that the evidence really supports the unlawful dangerous act manslaughter. Defence is saying no, it supports the negligence, and Her Honour needs to now make that decision.
So now the judge has to decide, beyond reasonable doubt, what the facts were. So she's going back and she's deciding the facts to some degree, which you normally think of as the job of the jury.
Yes, that's why this is a bit unusual. And I must say, this is a case, really, in my view, that points out the difficulty in this task, and maybe it's a case where we need to revisit whether this is the appropriate task for the sentencing judge. And by that, I do not mean that she won't get it right. I just query whether it's the appropriate way to go. In other words, it's my belief that we ask the jury to decide on the facts, and yet here we are. We're now asking the judge to do that.
Does this happen in many manslaughter cases, or many cases where a jury's come back with a manslaughter verdict?
No, it's very unusual. Criminal negligence itself is not left very often. It's a bit of an unusual form of manslaughter anyway. So no, I haven't had it before.
Michelle Williams SC thinks the situation where judges have to decide between two forms of manslaughter, that will only change if one of these unusual cases goes on appeal before a higher court. You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC News Radio. And part three of a special documentary series compiled over almost 2 years. There are, of course, two families involved in this trial, the family of the victim, Mark Zimmer, and the family of the accused, Leon Borthwick. This series follows the criminal trial process from the perspective of the Zimmer family. The story of the family of Leon Borthwick is not told here. On the 22nd of December 2010, the court convenes so Justice Catherine Williams can deliver her sentence. A group of about 30 friends and extended family come to court to support the Zimmer family. When they arrive at court, the Zimmer family are appalled to find that for the first time, the immediate family, that's Christian, Ruth and Cornelia, are not allowed to sit in the main ground floor section of the court. Cornelia, who arrives separately from the rest of the group, is particularly distressed.
Cornelia Zimmer didn't get to hear her brother's killer sentenced.
I was manhandled by the court staff, told to leave. I couldn't even just cry and rest in there before I was kicked out like the piece of trash that they think we are.
The Zimmer family was unhappy at being told to sit upstairs in the public gallery instead of in the court proper. Court staff wanted to separate them from Leon Borthwick's family.
I actually couldn't understand her logic. We'd been through a 7-8 week of trial. We'd been through the plea hearing. We sat with the Borthwicks and the convicted criminal in the same room. We listened to the proceeds. We didn't react. And all of a sudden, we come to the conclusion of 2 years of going through this court process, and we're not allowed to participate in it.
Being in the upstairs gallery, how is that not participating?
Well, it's like watching from the outside.
What could you see and what could you hear?
I could see the judge sitting there. I could see the back of some people's heads. And if I really strained, I could hear parts of what the judge was saying.
So you couldn't hear her reading out the sentencing remarks?
Not completely. I really had to listen very carefully to try to pick up the gist of what she was trying to say.
Cornelia, you actually didn't end up going into court. I was sitting with the other media and after a little while we actually could hear you shouting from the corridor. You weren't actually allowed into the court. What happened?
I was allowed into the court upstairs with the general public. At that point, I informed the guards that I'm the sister of the deceased and my family, my mum, me and my dad, had the right to be there and to see justice being done. And I said, I refuse to go upstairs. It's like just a constant fight, and it's a fight for our rights. And I hated seeing my parents be shoved up there like my brother's life meant nothing to them.
In a statement, the Supreme Court say that there had been a number of disruptive incidents during the trial involving the parties both within and outside the court. And the decision to separate the families was designed to prevent a repetition of earlier incidents. The court says this decision was not made lightly.
His father, Christian, is furious. The family was barred from the main body of the court. Justice Catherine Williams said the seating arrangements were made for security reasons.
Anne O'Brien, the head of the Witness Assistance Program with the OPP, and Senior Crown Prosecutor, Michelle Williams, both say that what happened to the Zimmers is unfair.
The prisoner's parents were in the body of the court, and who dictates that they should be the ones that are allowed there. I think it was most unfair.
So you obviously feel very, very strongly about this.
I do feel strongly about it because we prepare our victims, we prepare our families, and we prepare them in a way that we think is best for the court process. But if the court is not going to cooperate with us, then it's really counterproductive.
Anne O'Brien, do you share her view that that was unnecessary and unfair?
Very, very disappointing for the family of a young boy who's been killed to be told that they are not able to witness the sentencing, so their final part of a justice system, of the prisoner in a case involving the death of their son.
But they were there.
Yes, they were, and the acoustics in the Supreme Court do not lend themselves to being able to hear very well in the gallery. I felt very upset for them, and I felt that Cornelia had every right to feel the way she felt. If it was me, I might have expressed it differently, but she was not treated very well by security.
Looking forward, can any good come of this?
This has highlighted to us that we need to open a dialogue with the Supreme Court, particularly their security staff. We also need to be informed by the courts when they are going to put these things in place. And if the process changes, then we should be in a position to know so that we can notify our victims and prepare them for that.
Supreme Court Judge Catherine Williams sentenced him to 7.5 years jail, finding he had limited remorse for his actions.
The fallout over the seating distracts everyone from the business at hand, the sentencing of Leon Borthwick. The judge sentences Leon Borthwick to 7.5 years jail and 5 years non-parole. The maximum penalty for manslaughter is 20 years. I ask Christian how he feels about the sentence. He says he was prepared for it.
Look, he's not going to get more than the prosecution recommend as the minimum max. So therefore, if the sentence comes within that range, we'll be prepared to accept that and try to move on with our lives. And being 7 years and 6 months as a head sentence with a minimum of 5, that was within that range of the lower range of the prosecution recommendation, which we said that, we're prepared to accept that.
Cornelia?
The day before the court, I just thought to myself, I've absolutely no hope. I've no faith. I've got not even a glimmer that the value of my brother's life will be upheld in this court. So I went in there just thinking it doesn't mean anything because the sentence is so inadequate. As being 25% of the overall sentence that he could have got, I think that's a slap in the face.
Christian, you feel a bit differently from Cornelia.
Look, I originally went into it thinking that what am I prepared to accept? How many years is it worth the life of your child? And you cannot put an amount on it. You can't put saying, I'm happy with 10 years, I'm happy with 20 years. I mean, I wish he would get a life sentence. That's my wish, but I've got to go back to reality and I've got to go back to thinking that, am I going to let this person take the life of my son and also take the life of my family, or am I going to be able to come up with some sort of compromise decision? Now, we will accept that sentence, but we're going to continue to be involved with victims and lobby for the government to introduce minimum mandatory sentences of 50% of the maximum. So if there's a 20-year sentence, the minimum you can give someone is 10 years. 25% of a maximum sentence is really ridiculous. And I suppose most victims are really shocked when they get these low sentences, and a lot of them struggle to move on. And I saw a lot of these people that couldn't move on, and I didn't want to be in the same boat.
In sentencing Borthwick, the judge describes him in the moments before the crime as being both angry and scared, and determines that what Leon Borthwick did was criminal negligence manslaughter, not manslaughter by unlawful and dangerous act.
I'd give it a sentencing range of between 9 and 7 on the top, or the head sentence, and between 7 and 5 on the bottom. So it's the sentence that she gave, albeit it wasn't the form of manslaughter that we were urging her to find, nevertheless the sentence was within the range that we gave, because we said this was a serious example of manslaughter via criminal negligence, and that's what in fact she found.
And she wasn't satisfied that it was manslaughter by unlawful or dangerous act, because she wasn't satisfied that Leon identified Mark on the road and then deliberately ran his car at Mark. Is that right?
That's right. Her Honour was not satisfied that Borthwick had driven the car deliberately at Mark Zimmer. In fact, she went further and said, look, she wasn't satisfied that he, in fact, had recognised Mark Zimmer on the road, albeit that she was satisfied that he knew there were people and saw people on the road, but wasn't satisfied that he identified Mark Zimmer.
But the key was that the judge found that he didn't intend to knock him over or even drive directly at him and give him a fright.
Yes, that's right, and that was Her Honour's view. So we don't seek to quarrel with that, although it wasn't our primary submission, of course.
While satisfied with the result, Michelle Williams says the legal system has not served the Zimmer family well.
The frustrating thing is, no matter how hard we've tried, somehow or other, it just hasn't worked. And that tells me that something's wrong with the process and we've got to work harder at it. In other words, it can't just come from the prosecuting arm. We can't be the only ones that put in the effort here. If the system is failing the families, then it's a system. We are part of the system. We are one arm of it, but we're not the only arm. So I think there needs to be more work done.
What sort of work?
I think we need to recognise more fully that victims and victims' families are part of this process. They're not just a peripheral part of, to be, you know, yeah, just let them sit there and let them shut up and not be part of the process. They should be treated with respect.
Anne O'Brien, closure's a crappy word, but do you think that the Zimmers obtained any kind of closure or resolution from this process?
Well, yes, you're right, closure's a crappy word, but I hope that they have gained or will be able to gain some comfort from a system who has found the perpetrator guilty of manslaughter and a system that has punished him, that has incarcerated him for a period of time. No amount of incarceration brings Mark back, but this system has in effect worked for them and provided them with justice. But yeah, you won't hear me using the word closure.
While disappointed with the sentence, the Zimmers gained some comfort from the knowledge that their bumpy ride could lead to change. At a meeting in February 2011, officials from the OPP and the Supreme Court discussed security issues. The prosecutors sought an assurance from the court that in future it will discuss in advance with the prosecution any proposed changes to normal seating arrangements. If there is any change along these lines, Cornelia feels that, well, some good might have come from her family's experience.
Just like with the victim's impact statement, when that has caused massive change and has changed the way that victim's impact statements are treated, the way that judges have treated it has changed overnight, and I've actually had great feedback from that. And from the moment that I heard that that change was happening, the hurt and the disappointment that I felt lifted because I knew that it had changed future victims' lives.
Do you think that you will be able to move on?
It's really very early days. You know, we've got all intention of trying to move on. I think we've been further victimised by going through this process. It has ripped open a lot of new wounds, old wounds, and it's going to take a while to try to regather and try to move on from this, but we're really hoping that we can move on.
Move on, but also remember. In March this year, Mark Zimmer would have celebrated his 23rd birthday. The legal process is not complete. Leon Borthwick is appealing the sentence, but not his conviction. Since this program was made, Anne O'Brien tells me that no other family has been sent upstairs for a sentencing, and there are now regular meetings between the OPP and court security staff to identify and to avoid potential issues such as those that affected the Zimmers. That's the end of this three-part series. A special thanks to two people whose voices you didn't hear, Ruth Zimmer, Mark Zimmer's mother, and also Rose Feller, the Crown solicitor in the case. And also a special thanks to producer Erica Voles and to technical producers Nick Mirisch and Carrie Dell. From next week, breakfast will be extending until 9 a.m. That means the Law Report now has a new time slot at 5:30 p.m. every Tuesday. That's the Law Report for this week. I'm Damien Carrick. Catch you at 5:30 as of next week.